Welcome to episode 41 of the Active Photographer Podcast, your behind-the-scenes glimpse into the day-to-day life of a working professional photographer, with me, Giles Babbage. As you know, I have a very keen interest in the history of photography, and I'll always take the opportunity to speak with anyone who is an authority on the background of our wonderful art. This week sees another glimpse into photography's past, with the second part of my conversation with Roger Watson, who is curator at Laycock Abbey in Wiltshire, the one-time home of photography's pioneer, William Henry Fox Talbot. In part one last week, we stood inside the Fox Talbot Museum, talking about the man's background and his activities as a photographer. In this week's episode, it's time to take a gentle stroll around the grounds of Laycock Abbey, with thoughts turning towards the actual site of one of photography's first and most significant images. So, welcome, one and all, to The Active Photographer, episode 41. So, we're now outside and it's a bright, slightly overcast day. We've got all these lovely birds, are they swifts or swallows?
Swallows, I
flying
think, yes.
Around here. And we have in front of us the most magnificent building, and this was the site of probably one of the most recognisable, well-known pictures, what you might call that picture that Fox Talbot created. So, Roger, just tell me exactly what we do have in front of us here.
Well, this is very much the Talbot side of the building, because what we have here are three oriel windows, which are a type of bay window that's unsupported from underneath, and a octagonal tower at the end. But the three bay windows, three oriel windows here, were put in by Talbot between 1827 and 1830. So they were his addition to the building. The middle one, the smallest one, the least noticeable one, is the one that has the lattice work in it, and that's the one that he photographed for the first negative.
And why do we know why specifically he chose that window? Was it because it had more intricate detail to it, and that was obviously core to what he wanted to record, or is it just coincidence it was there, so he created this image?
It's a good question, and my thought on this is I've done a lot of work in 19th century processes as well, and when you're first working on a process, you're just trying to make sure it works. Mm. You're not looking for aesthetic criteria or deep philosophical whatever. And I think that's the perfect window to do. He shot it from inside looking out the window. And what he was looking for was strong light against strong dark. Mm. And that's exactly what that window would produce for him and did produce.
And do we know anything about what the conditions of what sort of day it was? Was it an overcast day? Was it a bright sort of summer's day? Or I'm only asking because I've got one of those minds that just wants to find out every last bit of detail. It probably doesn't matter, but as to whether that made a difference to him as to what he could expect to get or think how it might react.
I think that a lot of people looking at today being overcast would think this would be a bad day for shooting with 19th century processes. It's not. 19th century processes are working very much with ultraviolet light, which is not the same as bright sunlight. Mm. And in reality, sometimes an overcast day is better. Now, we've replicated the shot the last couple of years. We've been doing a workshop every year on Talbot's early processes. Mm. And with our mousetrap cameras, which were slightly larger than his, and his formula for the paper, we were doing good exposures of the oriel window in about 3 to 4 hours.
Crikey.
So still a long exposure. Not what you would call a great success in terms of speed. But we were getting great images from it. It was marvelous.
And of course, today, the only time people really expect to have exposures of that length is probably twilight, first thing in the morning, or in the middle of the night, star trails in the middle of the desert. That sort of thing. It's not a. It is well practiced now. There are a lot of photographers out there that love creating photographs at those times of day. But again, just goes back to what we were saying before. Everything is so immediate, so has to be created in this instant. What did his family, did he tend to say, I'm going off to do this now when there are other engagements you're supposed to be doing? Did he get very absorbed to it to the point that it actually created some sort of disturbance on an otherwise pleasant day?
No, his family was used to his eccentricities. He didn't like parties. He wasn't a big fan of having lots of people over for dinners and things like that, although apparently he was a very good host when he was being a host. But no, his experiments were constantly going on around the abbey. As a matter of fact, his wife began to call his little cameras mousetraps. That's where the name came from, because they were little wooden boxes that she found here, there, and everywhere around the abbey, and they just looked like mousetraps to her. So that's how she referred to them.
And where was his sort of his central base for his experiments? Did he have like a shed, or was it one particular room, or a wing of the building? Where
we know that he worked in a number of different rooms here. I don't think there was one set one. There was a shed out in the wood yard, which his daughters called Bleak House. And I think he did some of his work out in Bleak House, and probably kept his chemistry out there at least.
And I mean, we're stood here, as I sort of turn my back on the building, we've got sheep here grazing. We've got actually what, from my schooling days, we would call a ha-ha. In fact, we'll just take a little wander along. There's a gentleman attending to the grounds, and they are lovely grounds here. But we would refer to this as a ha-ha.
It is a ha-ha, yes.
Which is a wall which essentially has a drop the other side of it. Mm-hmm. I've heard various different theories as to what it was for. What I was told at school was that it would stop. Not only would it give rainwater somewhere to go rather than flooding the main lawns, but also it would stop any livestock from coming up and grazing. Was there a purpose specifically here?
I think there was, and it's a slightly different one from what you know, which is that it allows the landscape to be viewed from the road and look quite lush and pastoral with sheep grazing on it or whatever, but the sheep can't actually get to the abbey, but sure. You don't see the fence from the road.
And as I say, we can see there's a road just sort of in the distance in front of us. Has the landscape of this specific area changed much since the time that Talbot was here?
No, I don't think it has. And the road that you see, which is a little D road, it's a two-lane road, actually used to be the main road from London to Bristol.
Oh, right.
So it came right through Laycock.
You can't imagine it now, can we?
No.
The motorways that I've travelled to get here today, it doesn't bear thinking about.
It's not the M4, no.
So we're just walking along here. The building is to our left. We've got some signage that explains the sort of birds that you might see here. We've got sort of a corner tower, sundial. What is the actual the footprint of this area? What is the sort of the acreage, the scale of the land here?
To be honest with you, I don't know what it is right now. It's well over 100 acres that we have, but I'm not sure how much. I know that in Talbot's time, he had well over 1,000 acres and extended quite far out, but a lot of those were sold off over time to neighbouring farmers and things like that.
And did he have any sort of certain rituals that we know of? For example, a lot of creative people, you will read that they had to go for a stroll first thing in the morning to gather their thoughts, or they had to... was there anything that we know of with Fox Talbot? Because such beautiful ground, you'd be a fool not to take advantage of them, whether you've got a camera in your hands or not.
I don't know. I've never heard anything relating specifically to that. He seemed to work when ideas approached him. But he tended to work more at home. He didn't work when he's on the road quite as much. And he did spend quite a bit of time in London, but his stepfather had a house in London, so he would stay there when he was there. And I think that he was able to do some of his research and writing and possibly some experiments there as well.
And the sort of, obviously we've got some beautiful trees here which will have been here for a very long time, but we've also got flowers and what have you around sort of the borders. Are those the sort of flowers that, obviously, with the National Trust keeping the property up for the public to visit, has there been research into the sort of flora and fauna and the flowers that would have been there at the time?
Oh, lots of research, because Talbot himself, his first great love in science was botany. And he kept lots of journals and lots of notes. As a matter of fact, when he was 15, he and a friend, Walter Trevelyan, wrote their first book, and it was on the flora of the neighbourhood of Harrow, where they were both students. So yes, there's lots and lots of notes on what the property looked like at the time. We do know some of the trees here were planted by Talbot. Mm-hmm. But there's other things here which we don't know. We have to make some guesses and things like that.
And I've just noticed as we're walking along this path here, ever increasingly hearing that lawnmower catching up with us. And we have a what's labelled there as a monastic drain, mm-hmm. At ground level. But there's also there was a door or small doorway that was blocked up. Is that something that... What are these features? Are they important to Talbot, or is it just in latter years over the time since his death that they have been filled in or referenced?
No, most of the changes in the abbey go back to the fact that it began as a Augustinian convent for nuns. Mm-hmm. So it was an abbey, but instead of having an abbot and monks, mm-hmm. they had an abbess and nuns. And when the monastic houses were suppressed by Henry VIII. This was one of the last to be suppressed, the nuns chucked out. That's when a lot of the changes occurred to it. It was bought by one of Henry VIII's friends, a man named William Sherrington, and he did a lot of the changes in it. The first thing he had to do, it was part of the agreement, was to tear down the church, which was attached to the south side of the abbey, and dig up the foundation stones. There wasn't to be anything left of it. And he used that for building quite a few things. The octagonal tower on the corner, which we call mm-hmm. Sherrington's Tower, was built by him. And actually, the section we're walking along now, this is all the backside of the Tudor courtyard. Right. So this was all built during William Sherrington's period as well.
And presumably, the tiles on the roof are just beautiful. They look so weathered, and they are, in the most part, the original ones. Obviously, there needs to be repairs and upkeep over the years, but the glass in the windows and the drain pipes, are they essentially original?
Drain pipes, I doubt, are original, but most of the glasses, in some of the rooms you'll find where someone has engraved in the glass something and included a date. So I know there's one at least with 1735 on it. And those sorts of dates. The roof is typical of the Cotswolds. It's a stone tile roof. Mm. It's not slate, it's actual stone. And it's very heavy, but you do see it. Laycock is pretty much at the very south end of the Cotswolds, but you'll see it as you go north up through the Cotswold Valley as well.
And this is obviously such a well-known, well-established reference point, and is visited a lot. And obviously, is it we were just as we were having a bit of a chat as we were walking to this area before, sort of without the audio running, we were talking about Robert Capa and how some of his negatives were found in Mexico in a suitcase, I believe it was in an attic. Are there things that on site or through research that crop up which are just like a curveball? They're just completely unexpected, and it just fills in that little bit of the story. Is there anything specifically that has been discovered, say, over the last 10 years in and around the property, for example?
There's three things I can think of. In my early days here, I came in 2000, I think around 2001, Talbot's great-great-grandson, Anthony Burnett Brown, was living in the Abbey, and he came up to see me one day and said, we were moving some furniture because we have guests coming. I found something I think you might be interested in. Would you like to come and have a look? And of course, I would like to have a look. So I went up to the Abbey, and underneath one of the beds in a guest room, they had found a box that contained Talbot's lap desk from the time he was at Harrow, and it was stuffed full of papers and things like that. So there were some nice early pieces from his youth that we picked up on that. There was also, at one point, I was looking at a copy of one of Talbot's images called Head of Christ, which was a stained glass piece that had been used as a negative to make an image with. And I asked Anthony about that. And a couple of days later, he came back to the museum and he had it in his pocket and he pulled out the piece of stained glass, which let us know immediately that it wasn't the head of Christ because it was a gray-haired, gray-bearded man.
Oh.
So head of a saint. So something that an attribution title to that piece was wrong for over 100 years. So, which is quite nice.
Well, what about yourself, Roger? I mean, listeners, the more astute among them will probably suggest perhaps that you are not naturally an Englishman.
I'm certainly not a Wiltshireman, no.
How did you come to be at Laycock?
I came here in late 2000 on a one-year contract to begin the cataloging of the Talbot collection, the 10,000 letters, the 300 notebooks, the 2,000 images, all the other materials and things that we had here. And within 6 months, I decided I liked it here. I wanted to stay. And so I talked my bosses into another two-year contract, and then another 2 years after that. And then by that time, I was entrenched in Laycock and wasn't leaving, going anywhere.
So your name will be part of the legacy for many more years then?
I'll have to get a diamond and engrave my name on one of the windows, I think. That may be the best way to do it. But yeah, I hope so. The Talbot Collection has finally had its first cataloging, and I completed that in November of 2005.
And what does the future hold? Are there developments for more exhibitions, more awareness of Talbot, collaborations with other museums across the world? What is the future for Laycock and the Talbot story?
The collaboration is one of the things that I've been working steadily on. I made a visit earlier this year to Brie-sur-Marne, just outside Paris, which was the town that Daguerre retired to. And the town of Brie-sur-Marne has just bought Daguerre's old house, and beginning next month they're going to be converting that to the Musée Daguerre.
Oh, wow.
And I've talked to them about the idea of co-hosting a series of events in 2014, because that'll be the 175th anniversary of the announcement of photography.
Fantastic.
Both Daguerre and Talbot's announcement in January of 1839.
That would be quite interesting to have the two camps essentially in one room. And
there's been this idea that somehow that Talbot didn't like Daguerre and Daguerre didn't like Talbot, and that there was animosity between them. They never met, so there was no actual animosity between them. They never corresponded either. But for Talbot, the only five portraits I know of him prior to 1845, 1850, all five are daguerreotypes.
That's very telling, very interesting.
two by Beard and three by Claudet.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think, again, just as in the modern era, that the press, the public likes to create a bit of a story. Mm-hmm. And I think just on that issue, I often wonder when you see artists' work on the walls and someone will say, oh, what such and such was getting at was this, and it's all about the fragile nature of our existence and this, that and the other. You wonder how much that's just what other people want it to be. How was that the case with Talbot and his work, or was it just that it was an experimental development? There wasn't any real, other than appreciating the beauty, say, of the nature he was imaging, there wasn't any long drawn out story to his work, what we might call arts these days.
I think there was a bit of a story to it. He looked for not just how to make photographs, but he began to explore the idea of what use his photograph could hold in the future. Mm-hmm. And when he published Pencil of Nature beginning in 1844, he was using that as a method of showing that it could be used for portraiture, it could be used for architecture, it could be used for landscapes, it could be used to document objects that you have. There's one of the photographs in there is a scene from a library which shows a number of books on a bookshelf. Mm-hmm. So there were various uses for photography that he wanted to promote. So he was very much a broad-based inventor of not just the chemistry of photography, but he got started a lot of the art of photography as well.
Mm. And I, being a photographer, though not necessarily having an interest in the past, I personally do. I almost find more value in looking into the classical works of people from even right up into the 20s, 30s, what we might call the masters in the modern era. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I would encourage anyone to come here, because we're stood here, it's, you know, the sun is breaking through, I'm squinting. Yeah. This gentleman I'm talking to is considerably taller than myself, and so I'm currently squinting into a beautiful, ever-clearing sky here. Roger, I thank you so much for your time today. Oh. It's a fascinating story. I would obviously encourage anyone that is coming to the UK, anyone that is in the UK, you know, even if it takes them a few hours to get here, it's a beautiful property that, as I say, the story is one that is so compelling. How can people find out a bit more online? And obviously I'll be linking to this in the show notes and everything else we've discussed, but how can people get a first glimpse, other than Wikipedia, mm-hmm. of the story, the property, how to visit, and so forth?
There's a National Trust website, and if you go to that, you can click on the name of the property, Laycock Abbey, and it will take you directly to our web pages, and we'll show you the property, both the village, the museum, and the abbey itself. And another one I'd like to recommend to photographers out there is the website talbotworkshops.co.uk, because we've been teaching 19th century processes here for the last couple of years. We made our first daguerreotypes here this year. We're going to be teaching calotypes next year. Wow. So it's a great place to come and learn the processes as well.
I just might have to get myself along to one of those, because that would be fascinating. So again, Roger, thank you so much for your time, and I'm sure we'll be in touch.
My pleasure.
Thank you. If you didn't catch part one of our conversation, be sure to look it up. It's well worth a listen and will give you lots more information about Fox Talbot and his role in what has come to be photography as we know it today. You can check out all the show notes to this and other week's shows at theactivephotographer.com. If you'd like to get in touch directly, don't forget I'm on Twitter at Giles Babbage. You can check out The Active Photographer Facebook page, facebook.com/theactivephotographer. Or, of course, send me a good old-fashioned email, giles@theactivephotographer.com. So, thanks for listening, everyone. Take care, have a great week, and I will speak to you all very soon.
Member of the CurrentPhotographer.com podcast network. Find more great photography shows at CurrentPhotographer.com/podcast.